This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscowain. There's no fancy way to say this. The situation in Egypt is a mess. The country has been in a state of emergency after last week's violent military crackdown on protesters who supported ousted President Mohamed Morsi. It's estimated that as many as 1,000 people have been killed. The country has been going through dramatic upheavals, beginning with the Arab Spring 2.5 years ago that led to the downfall of then-President Hosni Mubarak. Mohamed Morsi was elected a year ago and quickly lost public support. The military removed him from office in July. That has left the Obama administration in a bind. The U.S. has long supported Egypt and given the country more than $1 billion a year for several decades. There are reports this morning that the Obama administration has secretly suspended some military and economic aid to Egypt while the president's team reassesses the U.S. relationship with that country. And just to add to the confusion, there's news that Hosni Mubarak could be released from jail sometime soon and that the spiritual leader of the Muslim Brotherhood was arrested today. Joining us from Cairo, Egypt is Nancy Youssef. She reports on the Middle East and the Islamic world for McClatchy Newspapers. And Nancy, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
What can you tell us about this spiritual leader who was arrested today?
Well, we heard reports late last night that Mohamed Bedi, who has led the Muslim Brotherhood, is the most important spiritual advisor to the Brotherhood, that he was arrested and that they had already named a replacement. Mahmoud Izzet, who's been a partner and deputy of his during his entire tenure as a spiritual leader. And so it suggests that the Muslim Brotherhood is having to adjust very quickly to essentially the decapitation of its leadership, as so many of its members have been either arrested, charged, or are currently being held by the current government.
Nancy, from your reporting from Cairo and other parts of Egypt, are we witnessing a civil war, the beginnings of some kind of a civil war?
You know, it's hard to say. There was a point where I would have said that was easier to answer a few days ago when the violence was so pervasive and people were so hostile and it seemed so nonstop. But we've hit a bit of a lull in the last few days as the Brotherhood hasn't been able to mobilize its street protests the way it did on Sunday and Friday, the days that you saw so many of those deaths. But I do think we're entering a period of persistent conflict and persistent instability, in that even though the Brotherhood is seemingly disorganized and a bit fractured right now, as it goes through all this tumultuous change and has endured a lot of violence, I don't think they're going to back down, and the government's shown no sign that it's going to back down. And so, as I put it in stories, the battle between essentially willing assassins and willing martyrs, the assassins being the government who says that the Brotherhood and its supporters are terrorists, and the Brotherhood members who have said that they're willing to die for this cause of defending their right to govern and they say defending the democratic outcome of the June 2012 elections that led to Morsi's ascension to the presidency.
And who was caught in between the military and the Muslim Brotherhood?
That's a great question. It's Egyptians who feel that this is wanton violence, they feel that this has led to further instability. It's hard to know because there are so many Egyptians here who believe that that the Brotherhood is the cause of the instability and actually back the government's crackdown on them, have almost become inured to the number of deaths that we're seeing, that they've become numbers rather than fellow Egyptians. That said, I talked to a number of people in the course of my work, and I asked them, whose side are you on? And usually the most common answer I get is God's side, and that what they really want is a return to stability, and that there's a quiet outrage at the indignity and the violence. But it's really being drowned out by a lot of shouting on both sides that they've been wronged and are fighting a just cause.
You had a profile of a woman named Soha Syed, as you described her, once an iconic face in a nation weary of an Egyptian government dominated by the military. Her husband was shot during the uprisings of 2011. She had called for the ouster of Hosni Mubarak. She had supported the Muslim Brotherhood. What did she tell you today?
Well, I met her during the Mubarak trial because she was out there in front of the courthouse every day calling for his conviction. And recently she's had a real change of heart where she once was convinced that the Egyptian security forces had killed her husband. Now she thought maybe the Brotherhood was involved, maybe it was part of some conspiracy involving Mubarak and the Brotherhood, that she went from being someone who thought that the Mubarak and a military-guided government was unacceptable, saying, I do accept it, and that Sisi, General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, the Minister of Defense and essentially de facto leader of Egypt, is actually saving Egypt from the terrorists that are the Muslim Brotherhood. And I just found it astonishing that someone who lost her husband to the forces of a military-guided government was now supporting its reinstatement and, in fact, its decision to usurp the democratic election that she had won. Protested for it, and in fact, her husband died for it.
Do you think she speaks for others in Egypt who had supported the Arab Spring and supported this change of government, and now are viewing the military in more benign terms?
I do, and that's why I used her, because I just thought if somebody who lost her husband to those elements could have such a change of heart, then what about other Egyptians who hadn't been so directly affected? And I should be clear, they're not just supporting the military. They're angry at the Brotherhood, and frankly, they're angry at the revolutionaries, the ones who promoted Rising Up, and who have since been rather silent and fractured themselves and haven't really been able to bring about the change that so many people protested and ultimately died for. The most common of them, Mohamed El-Baradei, the Nobel laureate, fled Egypt and went to Vienna. The day after he resigned from being vice president of this government, which was named by the military. And so I think the exhaustion with all these protests and all this uprising and all this demand for change that people are saying, I will take stability. And unfortunately for members of the Brotherhood and Morsi supporters, that stability has been defined for many as eliminating the Brotherhood threat.
And that's Nancy Youssef. She covers the Middle East and the Islamic world for McClatchy Newspapers, joining us from Cairo, Egypt. Not the greatest phone line, but we're happy to have you with us. I'm curious, Nancy, about how, when you talk to Egyptians, how do they view the United States? How do they view what the Obama administration is doing and has been saying over the last month or so?
Well, it's interesting that you talk to the people who are part of the negotiations that the Obama administration have tried to court in the run-up to all this violence between the Brotherhood and the government, and they say the administration did as best as it could. Deputy Secretary of State Bill Burns was here and stayed for several days trying to broker a deal between these two sides. But there is a feeling that the among the streets that what the U.S. is really looking out for is its own interests and not Egypt's interests. Many Egyptians will tell you that they think that the Obama administration, for some reason, sided with the Brotherhood because they had at one point endorsed and supported the Morsi presidency, and that they don't understand the Egyptian definition of democracy. And just because it's not the U.S. way, that their approach to it shouldn't be negated. It's probably what I hear the most often. But the talk about aid and cutting off aid, that debate that's so consumed in the United States, isn't as prevalent here because it's been really drowned out by more aggressive action by other nations. The European Union, so many members called back their ambassadors and their Egyptian representatives and essentially admonished them for the violence. So they seem to be taking a more aggressive stance, and the sort of in-the-middle position that the United States has taken, in a sense, it sort of made enemies on both sides. And so you don't hear a lot of people talking about a U.S. role going forward, but rather their ancillary source of frustration, if you will.
Nancy, I'm looking at a tweet that you sent out recently. You wrote, just came back from Fatah Mosque, where cop urged men around me to beat me up. Quote, she is an American, manhandled and now furious. We hear reports of, for instance, the State Information Service criticizing foreign journalists, I guess like yourself, accusing you and others of biased coverage of what's happening in Egypt.
That's right. The spokesman for the government had a press conference and said that both Egyptians are very bitter about the coverage because, from their perspective, they are taking out a terrorist threat that is the Muslim Brotherhood. And this coverage sort of focusing on the death toll and the fact that it appears so many of these people who were killed were not armed or in fact were peacefully protesting, the detention of so many people, the apparent torture of so many people, and now we're hearing reports of women and children being held. Just the level of violence has been something that the Western media has been focused on, and from their perspective, we're encouraging the Brotherhood to keep rising up. And so it's something that permeated every sector of the Egyptian population, including the security forces. And so when you go out to cover these events, there have been reporters who have been detained and asked about the nature of their coverage and what they think about the coverage. And certain stations are all but forbidden from working in this country, Al Jazeera being chief among them, because they're seen as a channel sympathetic to the Brotherhood. And so I was at the mosque, which was at the site of clashes between security forces and Morsi supporters who had staked out that place to hide during Friday's protest, and this went into Saturday. And the police officer was basically trying to take the attention off of him and put it on me and communicate this message that Westerners are not welcome and that we're enemies of the state. And he figured out it was American because I was showing him my government-issued press pass, which said they work for an American news agency. But the irony is, and I'm actually both Egyptian and American, but it was an opportunity for him to make, again, to sort of say that this government is protecting you from foes, domestic foes, the Muslim Brotherhood, and international foes, the Western media who's out to support and endorse and encourage the Brotherhood to continue the unrest that they're causing in this country.
In fact, both your parents were born in Egypt. Do you have family then still living there?
I do. My parents were born in Minya, which you might have heard of because that has the highest concentration of Christians of any city in Egypt, and where at least 12 churches were burned. And so I get a lot of on-the-ground reporting from them there, and I have everybody of my family here, which is a great source of news because there's so much diversity. I can find relatives who are on one side or on the other or amongst the security forces, and it's been a great way for me to tap into sort of how everyday Egyptians are feeling, and also to break away from what people are saying to a journalist, potentially out of fear or because they feel something they should say, and to really hear real voices. So I have you'd be surprised in a city of 20 million people how many times I hear about or just miss family members at protests and stuff. Mm. So
Nancy, thank you so much, as always, for joining us today in Radio Times. And not the greatest phone line, but we thought it was important to touch base with her. She is a reporter who's been covering the Middle East and the Islamic world for McClatchy newspapers for some time now. As she said, both her parents were born in Egypt, and she is based in Cairo, Egypt. We will continue our conversation. We have two more guests waiting in the wings as we talk about the crisis in Egypt, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Studio Incaminati, School for Contemporary Realist Art in Center City, supports WHYY and announces its weekly continuing education classes. Students can develop their artistic skills and learn new ones in small classes taught by instructors who are working professional artists. Drawing and painting classes for all skill levels focus on the portrait and figure, and there are special classes for high school students. Semester begins September 16th. Details at studioincaminati.org.
Next time in Studio 360, we take the show live on stage with a tough crowd that gives even great performers the jitters.
Every time I get nervous, I start to talk really fast. Nobody can understand nothing I'm saying, which is very frustrating for me, as you can imagine.
Actress-writer Sarah Jones and singer-songwriter Steve Earle join us at the Aspen Ideas Festival. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now, Congressman John Lewis, the last living speaker from the 1963 March on Washington.
And then we start walking down Constitution Avenue. We saw hundreds and thousands of people already marching. It was almost like saying, there go my people, let me catch up with them.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. In this hour of the show, we are deconstructing the crisis in Egypt and discussing some of the U.S. policy options going forward. Just said goodbye to Nancy Youssef, a reporter for McClatchy, who joined us from Cairo, Egypt. And joining us now from the studios of Bloomberg Businessweek is Romesh Ratnazar. He's international editor and deputy editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, also a fellow at the New America Foundation, where he writes on U.S. foreign policy. And Romesh, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us is Joe Stork. He is Deputy Director of the Middle East and North Africa Division of Human Rights Watch. And Joe Stork, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Glad to be with you.
Romesh, if I could begin with you, are we witnessing what looks like a civil war in Egypt?
Well, I think that's maybe going a bit too far at this point. Based on what Nancy said, it does seem as if things have settled down, and relatively speaking, they've settled down compared to where they were a couple days ago. I do think what we are seeing is essentially a restoration of the old regime. The people who are now in power are many of the same folks who served under Hosni Mubarak, and now there's some talk that Mubarak himself may be released, or at least see its charges against him dropped in some form. So I'm not sure that it's a civil war yet. Mm-hmm. I do think that the stage is set for a prolonged period of repression carried out by the security forces against the Muslim Brotherhood and their supporters.
Is this a coup? Was this a coup in July?
You know, I think it's hard to look at it in any other way. The Obama administration, as we know, has been reluctant to use that term because it would automatically trigger, by law, a cutoff in aid to the Egyptian government. But when you look at the facts, this is basically a military takeover, an ouster of a democratically elected government, which, by the way, was not performing particularly well and had lost the support of much of the Egyptian public. The way in which it was done, as far as I'm concerned, meets every definition of a military coup. And I think it's likely that the administration is going to be slightly more forceful. They may not come out and say that it was a coup, but I think they may, for all intents and purposes, behave as if it was one.
And I want to pick up on that. But Joe Stork, let me get you in on the conversation. We, of course, have heard reports over the last couple of weeks and certainly last week as well about the murder of a number of protesters in Cairo, revenge killings, reports from hospitals. From a Human Rights Watch perspective, how do you get information under these circumstances?
We have a small team of people based in Cairo. Some of them have been there for quite a while. Some came in response to this crisis. We get our information by going to the scene. We talk with victims and witnesses. We get their testimonies. We go to hospitals. We had a very hard time getting into hospitals, particularly on the day of the assault on August 14th. But that's sort of one of the ways we document this. We go to the morgue. We talk to officials as well as victims and witnesses.
And can you tell us, or from Human Rights Watch perspective, how many people then have died since this overthrow of the government back in early July?
I'd have to do the quick math on that, but you know we're talking about upwards of around 500 or so in Cairo on August 14th. There have been well over 100 in Cairo since then. There have been hundreds of deaths, in various parts of the country, adding up to hundreds of deaths. There is, I would say, just to pick up on your earlier discussion, I would agree. I wouldn't call this a civil war, and I certainly hope it's not going to move in that direction. But we're talking about a lot of civil strife, and in the Sinai, we are talking about if not civil war, a pretty active armed insurgency. So it's a pretty grievous situation. In terms of the numbers of deaths, of course, there were also several incidents after July 3rd and before August 14th where very large numbers of people were killed, illustrating that what we're looking at is not some sort of aberration. We're looking at a pattern of police brutality, of use of excessive force. We're looking at policies as well as horrific human rights violations.
And you're saying the police and military largely the perpetrators of this violence?
There's violence from a number of parties, but in terms of the overwhelming number of casualties and fatalities are the result of police violence, yes. But sure, there has been terrible violence on the part of Brotherhood or Brotherhood supporters or people acting in retaliation for the crackdown. We've seen attacks on churches. We've seen somewhere between 35 and 65 churches torched in the last, since August 14th, less than a week. A death toll of at least four people as a consequence of these kinds of attacks. We've seen attacks on police stations in which, fairly substantial numbers of police, a dozen here or there, have been killed, and in some cases their bodies mutilated. So we're certainly looking at violence on the protester side, if I may use that term generally.
Yes, I think we understand what you mean. Ramesh Ratnamzar, let me go back to you and pick up on what Joe Stork said about what's happening in the Sinai. From what you know, what is happening in there, what is happening there, and what is the significance?
Well, as far as we know, that the most high-profile incident was the attack by militants on some off-duty police officers, I believe, in Sinai, and killed about 25 of them yesterday. I think what it shows is that even outside Cairo, there's a great deal of instability, and the opposition or the Muslim Brotherhood and their allies could potentially become more radicalized and pose something closer to an armed insurgency if this wave of repression continues, which is likely to do. And of course, Sinai is a part of the region that in which other actors have interests, including Israel, and so there is a risk that a lot of other players in the Middle East are going to try to influence the direction of events there, and that makes it even more important that the United States and the Obama administration come up with a clear policy that makes it evident to everyone where the United States' interests influence really lies.
Well, let me pick up on that. And there was a long piece in the New York Times over the weekend about phone calls and visits by Secretary of Defense Hagel, Secretary of State Kerry, President Obama, all, talking to the military, asking them to, in a sense, hold their fire. There were, of course, some mixed messages coming as well. But the article seemed to say that the U.S. doesn't have much clout in Egypt. Would you agree with that, Ramesh?
I think we often overstate the extent to which we can influence events in Egypt or anywhere else. And it certainly seems to be the case that the efforts by members of the Obama administration to restrain the interim government from carrying out the crackdown against the Brotherhood really fell on deaf ears. At some point, I think we have to accept that our analysis of the situation is not necessarily one that the military in Egypt agrees with. I do think that we have an influence, and it may largely be symbolic, but I think that when the United States clearly says that it opposes and condemns the actions of the Egyptian government and that we are willing to suspend and reconsider the assistance we give to that government, given our history of support for Egypt and the long alliance we've had with that country. I think that will have an impact. Will it stop the violence immediately? I don't think so. But I think that it is important. Symbols do matter, and it's important that the United States state clearly what our interests and values are in Egypt, and that we expect the government to respect them.
But would it look like the United States was choosing a side by doing that?
You know, I don't think it necessarily would. I don't think it would change much in the way in which we are perceived as it is. I think everyone in Egypt has their own kind of analysis, as Nancy said, about which side the United States is on. At various stages, the U.S. has tried to work with the different players in Egypt, and in doing so has alienated those on the other side. I think the important thing is for the administration to work out what it is we want to stand for in Egypt, and what it is we want to see, and then from there devise and calibrate our policy so that we can try to affect that outcome that we hope to ultimately achieve there.
Joe Stork, what options do you see before the U.S., and then we'll get to some of our callers?
Well, I think I would agree that it's a difficult menu, actually, or it's not a very clear way ahead. I mean, I think in terms of the extent to which the U.S. has influence, obviously it has a lot of influence, but it has a lot less influence than it used to have in terms of what its, the sort of significance of the military aid, which has been kind of a constant figure for decades now. And especially in the context of aid being available to this new military regime from a number of other sources, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and so forth. So I understand the argument that, you know, to say cut off the military aid is not likely to result in the generals saying, "Oh my God, we have to do something about that. We have to get back on the straight and narrow." Probably not. I mean, I think there are other reasons why the U.S. should seriously consider that. Because it is symbolically important, and regardless of the direct influence it may have or the impact on the course of events, we're talking about something larger than Egypt. We're talking about U.S. credibility in terms of, you know, being potentially complicit in these kinds of killings. So I think that's another consideration that we have to keep in mind.
And that's Joe Stork. He's deputy director of the Middle East and North Africa Division of Human Rights Watch, joining us along with Romesh Ratnazar. He's international editor, deputy editor of Bloomberg Business Week, also a fellow at the New America Foundation. And we are talking about the crisis in Egypt and what U.S. policy options there are as we look into the future and go forward. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We have Hesham from Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. Hesham, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing, Mara?
Good.
Love your show.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Yeah, I was talking with your producer about, I was actually one of them people that I really elected Mohamed Morsi in the beginning, because it seems like it's the best choice at the time, because we didn't want nobody from the old regime or have ties to the old regime. But it raised a lot of concerns and red flags the way he governed and the way they set up the constitution. And what else it raised bigger flags is all these releases for the prisoners that were holded in terrorist charges, and they were a lot. And the last thing that really got me is that when he hired that government of Luxor, he was actually one of them group. They were accused in the 1997 massacre up in Luxor where all these people died. I mean, I'm sure you know about
sure,
that.
Sure, I do. Hesham, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, here is the thing, too. I'm trying to say everything I want to say. What's going on right now? It's really heartbreaking. I mean, this is not Egypt, what we wanted. This is not how it's supposed to be. And to be honest, brother, in one day or in one week. So why is it now like that? I mean, I have seen footage online and stuff like that. They had weapons, but not all of them. Of course, there is a whole lot of different kinds of people. But
sure, sure.
It's just heartbreaking. It's
well, I hear that, and Hashem, I appreciate the call, and Ramesh, I mean, I think he speaks for he's living here in Philadelphia. He's Egyptian by birth, but it seems he expresses a lot of the fear and frustration that a lot of Egyptians feel.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think frustration is a great word to use here, because there were a lot of people who were not necessarily supporters of the Brotherhood, who were secular Egyptians who supported the ideals of the revolution in 2011, who wanted to give Morsi and the Brotherhood a shot, and who were very disappointed with the performance and alarmed by many of the steps that the Brotherhood took that suggested that this was not going to be an inclusive government, that these were not individuals who respected the democratic process. And I think there were a lot of people who turned against the Brotherhood as a result. I think the army's view of the Brotherhood, however, and this is also something that the caller was getting at, is actually much deeper, more complicated, has a much longer history, and I think that the security forces and the army establishment truly does view the Muslim Brotherhood as an existential threat to the stability of the Egyptian state itself. And I think that now that the old regime is back in power, the kinds of steps that they are taking now and the kind of language they're using and this idea that they want to dissolve the Brotherhood, this is rhetoric that they've used for decades, and it has really been a historic conflict between the military establishment and the Islamist group. And I think that as a result, we're seeing a degree of violence that probably is of a scale that a lot of people didn't expect, but I think has deep historical roots.
And Joe, we're almost having a break here, but go ahead.
Well, I just wonder whether it's really accurate to say the army sees the Brotherhood as an existential threat. I am inclined to think they certainly have a weird sense of what's existential then, because I mean, I think it seems to me we're looking about a reconstitution of an authoritarian political order. Along the same lines as before the January 2011 events. And we're looking at a reconstitution basically of a police state, and that serves certain interests, including economic interests that the army has, for one thing. These weren't particularly threatened under the Brotherhood. So I think we're talking about a power play rather than an existential threat.
And that's Joe Stork again, Deputy Director of the Middle East and North Africa Division of Human Rights Watch, joining us along with Ramesh Ratnasar, International Editor of Bloomberg Business Week, also a fellow at the New America Foundation, where he writes about U.S. foreign policy. And we are talking about U.S. foreign policy and the crisis in Egypt. Hashem, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call us as well. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. What do you think is happening inside this country? And what do you think the U.S. should do? 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The WHYY Connections Festival is back with a day of free live music featuring They Might Be Giants, Ben Queller, and more. Saturday, September 7th at the Great Plaza at Penn's Landing. The WHYY Connections Festival is free for everyone, and WHYY members and sustainers get exclusive access to the member Oasis tent all day long. They Might Be Giants and more, Saturday, September 7th at the Great Plaza. For a full lineup and to register, visit whyy.org/connectionsfestival.
On the next Fresh Air, hear about the internet company so determined to escape government regulation it took its servers to an abandoned fort in the North Sea. Nate Anderson tells that and other stories about authorities cracking child pornography sites, spam and botnets, all arising from the freedom and anonymity of the online world. His book is The Internet Police. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Eric Holder's Justice Department thinks it can still challenge voting laws in the state of Texas. Some Texans have other ideas.
You all have heard about a straw man argument. This is a dead law argument.
Our guided tour of voting rights since the Supreme Court decision Shelby versus Holder begins in Texas. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Romesh Ratnasar and Joe Stork about the tumultuous and violent summer in Egypt. President Mohamed Morsi was ousted from office in early July. Last week, the military cracked down on Morsi protesters in Cairo, leaving hundreds dead, many more wounded. There have been attacks and revenge killings in other parts of the country, destabilizing this volatile but very important region of the world. President Obama's call for calm. He called off joint military operations, is apparently reassessing the U.S. relationship with Egypt. And there are reports this morning that the Obama administration has secretly suspended some of the aid that we have been sending to this country. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Joe, I want to pick up on something you said earlier about the U.S. being complicit in what's been happening in the last few weeks in Egypt. Is it because the U.S. has been sending money that the Egyptian military then has used for weapons and used those weapons to get some of its people?
Well, no, I think the weapons that the U.S. has sent and financed for the army are not weapons that have been used in breaking up these demonstrations or in, you know, I mean, these are not the kind of weapons they use for crowd control and so forth, by and large. I mean, there may be exceptions, but by and large, that's the case. I'm talking about a broader issue of appearance. I'm talking about support for a political establishment, in this case, military rule, where you're basically, providing some assistance, some considerable assistance to this to these rulers. It may not be directly applicable to the kind of repression we're starting to see, but it's still an issue.
I'm curious, Romesh, then we will get to our callers, but what other, besides money and phone calls and entreaties, what options does the U.S. have?
Well, you know, there is the simple moral force of the presidency, and I mean, the president did make a statement on last week in which he condemned the violence in Cairo, and that was important and probably was belated. I think we have a historic relationship with Egypt and with the military itself, and that is an important relationship to the Egyptians. And at the moment, they may not be inclined to necessarily change their behavior based on whether or not we are delivering the weapon systems that we have contracts with them to provide. But I do think that the leverage that we have is still relevant. I do think one important thing to remember is that I think the worst scenario that the administration is probably trying to avoid is cutting off aid and making a big show of cutting off aid and then watching the Egyptians go forward and carry out even worse brutality. And so there is the argument that you can only play this card once, and to some extent, there is perhaps some value in holding it in reserve until you reach a point where you truly have to say something, and you don't want to have already used up the one piece of leverage that you have.
But do you think all the players in Egypt have ended up hating the United States for its pronouncements, its decisions, its lack of decisions? That we're the troublemaker there?
I think that's the case, largely speaking, and I think it's a reflection of the terribly polarized situation that we've seen, which is not something that's arisen just in the last week. We're looking at a situation that's developed, you know, really since the January 2011 uprising, where the U.S. contributed to this by some of the things it said and some of the things it hasn't said over the course of that 2.5 years. But I think it's really a reflection of the sort of, if I could say, the degeneration of the situation in Egypt itself.
What do you think, Romesh? We'll get to our callers.
I agree with that. I mean, yes, I think the United States has at times lacked a sort of clear, overarching principle that's guided our policy toward Egypt. I think we've pursued a policy of sort of pragmatism and trying to work with everyone without necessarily being clear about what we ultimately wanted to see there. But I think the fact that all sides blame us is more a reflection of the situation and the polarization within Egypt than it is anything to do with any particular aspect of our policies.
Let me get some callers in. Looks like we have Jerry Sorkin joining us on Radio Times, lives in Tunisia and also lives here in Philadelphia. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having a great show, as always.
Thank you.
I think what we're seeing now in Egypt is something that Edward Djerejian, a longtime State Department official, said in one of his speeches when he talked about the democratic goals of Islamic radicals, and that was, he said, one man, one vote, one time. And particularly since Bush Jr.'s terms in office, when we were really trying to push in the Middle East our democracy, what we felt was democracy as needed in the Middle East, while that may all sound good, I think what we're now seeing happening in Egypt is perhaps the prediction of Djerejian, what he's saying. While, yes, Morsi was democratically elected, but once in office he did anything but govern in a democratic way. I know in Tunisia we're watching this very carefully as well.
Sure.
And one only has to look at what's going on in Syria and some of the other countries in the region, that Libya and even Lebanon, and the concerns we have. And I think it's now a time for the U.S. to really have to reflect on what is it that these regions want. And what people want most of all is something Nancy Youssef said. They want economic support, they want economic well-being, and they want stability. And while it's politically incorrect, I know in Egypt, I know in Tunisia, I know even in Syria, people are saying in the cafes and in the privacy of their homes, we would like to have what we had before. That doesn't mean they want the man Mubarak or the man Ben Ali or the man Assad, but you can't have a democracy without stability and economic improvement.
Well, Jerry,
and none of that is happening in Egypt. And I think we're seeing that we have to reflect on this.
That is a very interesting point. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Romish, let me give you a chance to pick up on that. The idea is that democracy doesn't fit the Middle East. I think that's what Jerry is saying.
Well, you know, there is that argument out there. I think that it's too soon to tell. I mean, I think that the experiment in democracy in Egypt, while it has certainly not turned out the way a lot of people both in Egypt and in the rest of the world might have hoped after the 2011 revolution, I don't think it's over. If you listen to what a lot of folks in Egypt are saying right now, there is a belief that even though there has been essentially restoration of the old regime, that the fact is that because of what happened at the beginning of 2011, this government going forward at some point is going to be held accountable and will have to be responsive to the will of the Egyptian people. The fact is, at the moment, I think Nancy Youssef made this point, the majority of Egyptians, to the extent that we know how they feel, are at the moment waiting and seeing. They're not necessarily condemning what the military has done against the Brotherhood as brutal and ruthless as it has been. So I still believe that it is important for the United States to promote liberalization and political development and democracy where it can. I do think that we've made a mistake in some cases in overemphasizing and perhaps assuming that if you held an election that somehow these countries would become liberal democracies. Clearly that's not going to happen, but I don't think that democracy is necessarily, we can declare it a failed experiment in the Middle East.
How do you see it, Joe Sork?
Can I pick up on that?
Yes, please.
Look, first of all, I mean, regarding Edward Djerejian's statement of, 20 years ago or more about one man, one vote, one time, yeah, but it wasn't Morsi and the Brotherhood. It was the army who pulled the plug on, made it sure it was just one time. So, yes, there are many areas in which Morsi behaved. He played very majoritarian politics. It was dumb. It was counterproductive. It certainly didn't embody the spirit of tolerance and compromise and so forth that has to be part of a working democracy. But I think, at the end of the day, it was the army who moved in and put this down. Secondly, just on the point of people getting fed up with this, I mean, it didn't take, my colleagues were on the ground at the Rabah al-Adwiya sit-in in the days and weeks before it was crushed on August 14th and then actually observing it during that crackdown and in the days after. And it's true that many of the residents of that area who were totally fed up with the Brotherhood sit-in and the great disruption it created for their lives wanted it over. But they expressed, some of them, not all of them, but some of them expressed, great shock at the ferocity of the way the dispersal was carried out. And we're hearing, people being upset by the not just the kind of vigilante checkpoints that are all over the place, particularly at night, but also some of the army checkpoints and the behavior of the police. So, yeah, I think, it's absolutely correct to say we're not talking about something being put back in the bottle in terms of what people, what Egyptians really want, because it's not just economic prosperity. It's sort of political dignity as well.
Let me see what Rebecca from Glenside has to say. Rebecca, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I have a friend who's a physician and from Egypt. His family's in Cairo. He listens to Egyptian news all the time. Two things. One, he said that Morsi was harboring terrorists in the Sinai Peninsula. I haven't heard anybody say that. Not that I follow everything. But the other thing was that he says that it's not a military coup because it was the will of the people. It was the will of the people before it was the military coup, and that is critical, and the military simply carried it out for them.
And the will of the people, not by vote, Rebecca, but by just what, protest, demonstrations?
Yes, protesting, yes.
Well, let me...
Protesting, and so I'd be interested in hearing, because I haven't seen that middle ground. All I hear people talking about is it a coup or is it not a coup? Well, is it a military coup or was it, he has this whole other category, the military simply fulfilled what the people wanted that they demonstrated through protesting.
Well, Rebecca, I'm going to toss that, if you don't mind, Romesh, I'm going to toss that first to you and then to you, Joe.
Well, that's an argument that I've certainly heard, and, I don't accept it. I mean, I think the idea that the military was somehow kind of acting by proxy and enforcing the will of the Egyptian public. I mean, just simply because there were masses in the streets calling for Morsi to resign, I think is not accurate. And the fact is, what we have seen in the days since then suggests that this was not some sort of military coup or military move that then was done on the behalf of the kind of liberal voices in Egypt. The military did this on behalf of its own interests and has restored itself to power in ways that we haven't seen since the 2011 revolution. So I just don't accept that this idea that this isn't a coup because there are people in the streets who wanted to see it happen.
Joe, just jumping off of Rebecca's question, but I just, from here, are we seeing also, or perhaps another way of looking at this is kind of the growing pains of a new democracy, or is that too much sort of a rosy scenario?
Well, look, 2 points. I mean, first of all, a lot of the people who went in the streets, the masses who were in the streets on June 30th, and in the whole period leading up to that and after that, were calling for the army to move in. I mean, let's not be, that is a fact, including many, many liberals supported that explicitly. That, however, the fact that it was a coup with popular support doesn't make it any less of a coup. Mm. It did have popular support. It had a lot of popular support, far from unanimous. And whether the extent to which that popular support is going to continue as this police state gets reconstituted remains to be seen.
And we're almost out of time here. Romesh, let me go back to you. But as you look at what's going on in Egypt, when we're talking about a lot of the players and the serious crisis there, what options are before the Obama administration, and what do you think is in the U.S. national interest?
Well, you know, I think the options are limited. You know, we have the aid that we provide the Egyptians, and we're already hearing that the administration is, if not suspending it, certainly is reconsidering how it disperses that aid, how much of it is going to be sent to the Egyptians in the next few months. I think that what would be important for the administration to do is state clearly and forcefully that the United States does not support the use of force against civilians. It does not believe that Egypt should be run by a military government indefinitely, and we want to see a quick return to civilian control. On the other hand, we have to be mindful of the fact that how that's done and the timeline in which it's done is not necessarily up to us to decide.
And for you, Joe Sork, final words.
Look, Egypt is going. You asked whether we're talking about a long road to democracy. I think we're talking about a long drawn out revolution. Whether it's going to end up a democratic revolution or not remains to be seen. But I think that's what we're looking at. When January 11 was kind of a first phase. You could even go back and talk about the Kefaya efforts in the sort of 2005-2006 as a first stage, perhaps. This the events of July and August are another phase, a particularly bloody phase. How it's going to end up, I don't know. Certainly, there are a lot of Egyptians who clearly do want to have a voice politically participate in the future of their country, which to me is the essence of democracy. So I think I still am optimistic about that.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Joe Stork, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And Ramesh Ratnasar, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And we began with Nancy Youssef, who joined us from Cairo, Egypt. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and find out much more about this program, including podcasts and email archives, Facebook and Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.